Hey everybody, Solidarity House Cooperative is now on iTunes and Spotify, as well as Podbean and Patreon. You can go to Patreon to support us and any of those platforms to hear us.
And we're inviting our newest member to join in the check-in conversation, and that is Matt's hair!
I can't speak for my hair.
I think it speaks for itself.
It
pretty well speaks for itself.
And I think that it is saying that it can do whatever the fuck it wants.
Yep, that is exactly right. The thought of $4,000 owed by the 16th this month is fucking terrifying. I still have hope for our community. I still think that we're doing whatever is possible to make it work. So if it doesn't work, it won't be for lack of a fuck ton of trying. And I do think that we still can make this. I think that it's possible. I have doubts, like I always do, but they're much more focused on holy shit, capitalism is awful, than they are our own dynamics and the way that we're trying to do things. So I am in an extremely hectic and ambivalent place, feeling multiple emotions at once, but the overall, prevailing emotion is, desperation, but an optimistic one.
I feel like I'm in a little bit of, emotional disconnect from that. And still doing the things that we need to be doing, so that hopefully it won't be that number. Maybe I've just sort of gotten inured to the financial panic that it isn't driving any more of that for me, even though objectively it probably should be. So, yeah.
What caused the leak?
The pipe broke, right? It was the hot water pipe from the old washer hookup in there. And so when he pulled it up, it was just spraying out. So he had to pull it up because it was sort of the part that broke was in between the two levels of the floor. So we couldn't actually see it when you were down there, nor could you see it. He was just it seems like it's coming from the floor. And I'm I didn't see anything up there. And it was because it was in between the two layers. And so it was just spraying up and out from that spot.
How long do you think it's been doing that?
What I'm wondering is if it was a little crack and then it got bigger, because we were seeing a gradual loss of pressure. It wasn't all of a sudden we had no pressure. So I'm wondering if it's actually been slowly getting bigger and bigger for a week or so.
I mean, unfortunately, the amount of water that was down there, it's got to have been happening for a while.
I feel this a tremendous amount of resolve and kind of commitment to continuing to dive into this and find a way to make the commune work, because I truly feel that we belong here and that we are doing already amazingly good things with the space. Because of that, the energy will come our way. So I've become really new agey about a lot of this. I kind of feel like you have to believe that it will happen in order to make it happen, and that you have to believe you deserve it.
I mean, yeah, we know that all of this is just super wet and gross. I mean, there's a pipe that's not physically connected even. There's just a pipe sticking out of the wall here that doesn't actually connect to anything. There are valves over here that... Okay, so I can see water lines right here, but they don't seem to be the ones that are leaking. It's something above us. And I don't know, maybe it's one of these ones? How does that... I don't know how they actually flow through. It's all a complicated jumble of shit. It's slow but steady.
Well, I guess we need to get the lines drained, and then we'll know whether it's now just backflowing, or up there and I actually have it off or not.
I don't know if Jabron actually did start doing the thing since he heard you coming up, but we'll start that going. Okay. And try and walk past all of the random boards and carpet that's just up here. There's some shoes. There's a toilet.
Nice.
And a sink. He just kept stuff down here, I guess. Oh, and there's a couple shell cups, like from the gas station. Like
nice.
Some soda pop was had. Along with the Coors beer.
Just asked if we're recording this.
Yeah. And Coors Light, that's good. Good, they had variety. That's nice.
Did you get the water out of the pipes?
No, what do you mean? What do I do to do that?
Just open the taps and catch whatever water you can catch and until it stops flowing. Because
okay.
We don't know if like the what's dripping down here now is backflow and I actually have the water shut off or if I don't have the water shut off.
Wee.
All right.
Yeah, so what is this then? Is this like the septic runner?
Maybe. Could be the sewer pipe.
Yeah.
Could be. The shit pipe?
Yep.
It the shit pipe?
Is it the shit pipe? But yeah, so I it's definitely over in this far corner where you're saying. But I can't tell which pipe is doing it.
Okay. Can you stay in there? I'm sorry.
It's fine.
A little bit longer, and as Jabron is like emptying the water out of the pipes upstairs, see if it stops flowing.
Yep, I will sit here in super creepy insulation basement.
I'll stay with you.
Okay, thank you. and there's like a bunch of like little rubber connector things that look like they've fallen off here. They look like little snakes. Yeah, really weird curled snakes.
He doesn't even have the pipes wrapped up here with any kind of insulation.
Nope.
Just like basically as vulnerable as it can possibly. This is why we wanted it replaced.
Yep.
2 months ago.
2 months ago. We
asked to get it replaced.
Yep.
They said they were coming to replace it.
Yeah, they said they were coming after Thanksgiving.
Actually, that was a reschedule. They said they were coming 2 weeks before that.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And then.
I was on this. Can I just say I was on this? And was like, I want the pipes replaced before it starts freezing regularly.
Right.
Because
this shit happens.
Yes.
Yeah, this is real irritating. And honestly, I kind of vaguely remember getting a call when I was at work from a number that wasn't familiar to me around Thanksgiving, like right after. There's some extension cords that have been laying in dirt forever. I'm gonna take pictures. It's okay, I'm just talking to my phone, which will eventually be talking to podcast people. And then I'm gonna take pictures. No, except it went dark. Because my flashlight uses my flash. Here, boop. Some cool electric cords, and here is the underside of our pipes. You can see what Yana was saying. What? If anything, it got faster. And here's the toilet that is just down here. And here is the sink that's just down here too. Let's see. I don't know what these are. What?
Did it change at all in the last minute or so? I'm now just talking into this black.
Yeah, I know. I'm here. I promise. I think it's gotten slower. That sounds a bit slower. I mean, it's still a steady trickle. Honestly, I think it's about the same as it was before you started doing anything. And beautiful insulation. Look at that beautiful insulation. It's so pretty. Okay. And no more pictures, because that leaves me in the dark without my flashlight. And that sucks. Okay.
What are you?
Oh, just empty can. Cool. Okay. Kind of disappointing. Lots of spider webs. Thankful I'm not scared of spiders. The ground, the dirt is glistening with beautiful ice crystals that I'm sure are great for our pipes. Yeah. Also, I don't know why the insulation's like falling down off of the things. It's not. I'm gonna pause because there's nothing interesting happening right now. Except, you know, stressful shit.
Maybe because it's just been super neglected down here and.
Yeah. Yeah, the wetness, like, so it extends. So the pipe, I think a pipe has burst back up in this corner, but the entirety of this ground here is wet. Uh-huh. It's wet all the way out to here, which is,
well, and it's just a jackass setup. He's got it sitting on the ground there, you know?
Yeah, 6 yards worth of wet dirt here. Okay. I mean, not 6 yards, 2 yards. 6 feet. 6 feet is what I meant to say. Good gracious.
I mean, 6 yards was believable, too.
Yeah, yeah, that's true, but I think it's, I just call that like 2 yards worth of wetness. There's a really rusty saw down here.
Awesome.
That's cool. I'm going to take a picture of that, too. I've just been taking pictures.
Go to the apartment right above you and check the water there.
Okay.
Because it could be if the pipes right there still have water, that's what might be back.
Yeah. I do think the drip has gotten a little bit slower. Matt is messaging us to the status of stuff and just said continuing to decrease, now increasing a little. I promise I'm not making this up. What? I think she was trying to communicate with me. But I cannot hear through the roof very well. Oh, fascinating look into the world of home ownership. It's stressful. Super stressful.
What the fuck are you talking about?
It's the drips of water that are coming off of these pipes. I got a couple pictures because they range from piss color to blood and any stage of like red, orange, grossness in between.
And they're gonna send somebody out.
Cool.
But they've got mine. I realized I should have given them multiple phone numbers because now it pretty much means Matt and I are not going anywhere.
Oh, yeah, shit. So I have to stay. I mean, yay, we'll just eat lots of tamales. That's my normal.
It's true. I mean, we do have other food too, but we just haven't run out of tamales yet, was what my point was.
Okay, yeah, and I still have some in my freezer too. I haven't eaten all of them, so.
Alright, so you want to come out?
I do think it's slowing down. There's one spot where the insulation got soaked, so that's just a constant trickle. But it's, cutting. Yeah, but it's the insulation being wet. Oh. I think. Well, that's nice of it. Thanks there. Now that it's not really useful to us? Cool. So now we have half an hour worth of
bitching.
Yeah, well, and me sitting here like, nope, not scared at all. That's a cobweb in my hair. Doop, 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 doop. Gonna take a picture of this real creepy looking thing. So it's like, other people know about it. And I'm gonna take pictures so that I can look back and see all the demons that are, you know, in the periphery later.
Nice.
So that's okay. Exciting.
We do have ghosts in the house. It'd be a nice time to, like, stick your ectoplasm in the pipe.
That would be great. I don't know how ectoplasm works, though. So if it's something that would make it worse, then don't do that.
Maybe not.
Then never mind. Yeah. Should read up on our ectoplasm.
Are you ready to come out?
Yes. I have to stop this, though. So bye, everyone. We'll tell you what happens later, probably.
Frankie, also known as Francesca Voltz, and let's see, I'm here because I know Yana from living in the tri communities in Northeast Missouri, and I write mostly poems, and yeah, one thing I really like to do is hang out at places like the farmer's market and write poems to go for people with my typewriter.
What's poems to go?
Well, basically, I think of it as a little bit, I don't tell people who are ordering a poem, but I think of it as it's sort of like one part therapy session, one part like tarot reading, and one part poem. But basically people will order a custom poem. So I just ask them to name their subject, and then I will ask some follow-up questions and then type them a poem. And then they will leave a donation, which is usually money, but sometimes it's like, oh, I just made this granola. Here's a batch of fresh-baked granola.
Nice.
And then I read them their poem, and then they take it away.
Cool. And you do this with a non-electric old-fashioned typewriter, is that right?
Yeah.
I've seen you do this. It's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love my typewriters. I have three.
Cool. Okay, well, you want to... Well, let me ask this. So you just came off of a writer's retreat. It was kind of like a fellowship, or what's the right word for it?
It's a residency.
Residency.
I am always curious what is the right word, because some people will call it a fellowship, some people call it a residency. But, yeah, it was at this place called Brush Creek. They have a foundation. It's this 15,000-acre... ranch, and they have a foundation there that has 8 artists there at a time for 3 weeks, and it's usually 2 musicians, 4 visual artists, and 2 writers, but you know, it varies from time to time.
And this is near Saratoga?
Yes. Okay. Which is what, a 2-hour drive from where we are, right here in Laramie.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's pretty remote out there. There are a lot of trails, so you can walk around. And so I'd try to get out every day and walk around. Because I think for me, having that sort of like embodied activity, or that physical time, is a really good balance for the more sedentary thinking, sitting time. I think they really feed each other. So, yeah, I was just there for 3 weeks, which means I have some newer pieces that were just born that I can share with you all.
All right.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Brand new work.
Yeah.
From Francesca Bolz.
You heard it here first.
Can't awesome. Wait to hear them.
All right.
Great. Yeah, go for it.
Okay.
But you should let me know. I've pulled 6 pieces out, and 3 of them are newer, and 3 of them are older, and I don't know what kind of time frame we're looking at, or what you wanna hear.
Matt, what do you think?
Anything that you want. I mean, I think it would be exciting to do the new stuff, but it's really up to you.
Okay. Well, for some reason it feels like the older stuff informs the new stuff, even though you can hear the new stuff and you don't need to hear the old stuff. So maybe I'll read a few of the older ones that just feel like they give more of a sense of a background or where I was coming from. And then if you don't want them, you can just cut them out.
Awesome. Editing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Okay.
So I've been reading and writing a lot about water in the past quite a while. I mean, it feels like a lifetime project. And so most of these are from, or I think all of them really fall under that water project category. And I also really like to footnote my work. And so this first one, maybe you don't need to know the footnotes, actually. But I will just say that I was really affected by an article I came across right around the time What's-His-Face was elected to be our so-called president. And I was just so overwhelmed with everything that was coming in, and was pretty numb, too. And then I came across this article about a whale that had washed up off the coast of Norway and was, you know, sickly and dying. And some researchers who dealt with the whale eventually euthanized him. And when they opened him up or her, I don't even, this whale, when they opened the whale up, there were over 30 plastic bags inside, which were obstructing the, you know, they're in the intestines and just obstructing the digestion and other processes, and were the cause of this whale's death. And so that, for some reason, I had a response to in the midst of all this other stuff that was I was being barraged with and couldn't really think about somehow or couldn't process. So this piece is a little bit about that and just this obsession that has been happening in my writing about plastics in the water, in the ocean. And they keep coming back. The plastic stuff keeps coming back in my work in the same way that it's like, oh, it keeps being there in the ocean. It keeps showing up in the stomach of seabirds, and it keeps showing up. And so that's one thing that's happening. In this piece called Pouring the Prayer, this thirst brings us together, gathering around a spill, the cool dribble, this trickle stored in blasphemous vessels bound to break to bits, brittling in the guts of gulls, the GI tracts of salmon, while whales wash and wash ashore. Their weakened bodies ushering in the panic, the mobilization, the muscle sore work to turn them right, to send them back. But they keep signaling with their barnacled flesh, with their fatigued fins, with their plastic-filled intestines and bone-shaped ribs showing through thick skin, they keep drifting in towards tireless humans pouring bucket by bucket the water over and over and over them, pouring the prayer, pouring the sheen back over ocean-blacked skin, pouring the prayer that they might thrive, that they might make another great migration, that they, that we, that they might make it, that they, that we might be okay. It
just makes me think of the concept of away, like we throw things right away, but they go somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, and they do things when they get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, it's inescapable, you know, like what is my computer made of? What is this hoodie made of? It's plastic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Very pervasive. Well, I think about borders a lot. And so the next two are about borders. This one's called I Prefer Rivers. We filled the space with our bodies. We had so many things to say. We constructed signs with the markers we had on hand. We made sound with our words, with our song. We tried to get our point across. But there is a point that always feels bigger, louder, mightier, wider. I've seen what can happen when a human is allowed to be wilderness. I want to see it again. I mean, we were never meant to be contained, and there is so much relief, such gratitude when the option is a line to be filled in rather than a box to be checked. Fences are better because there is space for air to move through, for creatures to dig under to get to the other side. Fences are better if we must choose, but really, I prefer rivers, canyons, ridges, creeks, not as things to separate one side from the other, ours, theirs, here, over there, but as a thing to marvel at, how the light moves on the water pulling itself over rock, how the green things insist on growing in the most unthinkable spaces, roots tangling in the fracture of a great stone, how the tree needles comb gusts of wind as they bluster through, how we all have so much in common. So some of the footnotes on this next one I thought were really interesting, and I think they're useful to know in terms of what's happening in the poem is that I was really curious to learn that bodies of water can change because, you know, I think of a map and I think of, well, you look at a map and the stuff is always on the same place in the map. Unless, I guess, if you're looking years earlier or years later. But I realized I had this idea that, like, a lake stays in the same spot. A river's always been where the river was. But I came to learn that rivers, like various animals and people, tend to migrate or move or change as the depending on what happened that season in terms of flooding or rainfall. So that's one element that shows up in here, is just that rivers themselves kind of migrate and move around if they're not dammed, which, or, you know, sort of channelized or mm-hmm. messed with in a way that has people being like, wow, you must stay in the same place forever.
Right, so I must control you. Yeah. Which is actually interesting because you can end up with some really bad, like, natural disasters when a river insists on going where it wants to go instead of staying where people have cemented it in.
Yeah.
That's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like I just witnessed a couple of those. You know, there were some spillways that gave way when mm-hmm. there was a bunch of rain where I live in Viroqua, Wisconsin, this spring or summer, I guess it was. Yeah, we see that mm-hmm. a lot. And then one other thing is that over a third of the total length of international land boundaries worldwide follow rivers or streams. So that was an interesting thing. And then, what is it? There's one other. Oh, since the mid-1990s, the flow of the Rio Grande has been at record lows, and only in exceptionally wet years does it reach the sea. So all of those things are relevant to what's happening in this one. Called I Never Heard a River. I never heard a river say, because I have a tendency to draw lines straight or scraggly, use this body as a border. I never heard a river say, use my body as the line that determines who is legal and who is criminal, thereby choosing whose status as human is to be revoked. I never heard a river say, use my body as a conspirator, carrying off the bodies of those who never arrive. Use my body as a governing over othered bodies to issue penance for those who trespass. Use my body contingent on amnesia and unacknowledging of appropriated land. I never heard a river insist, use my body in collusion with concrete columns, corrugated steel, razor wire, whatever it takes, make it climb proof. Use my body in collusion with agents armed with submachine guns, shotguns and pistols, pepper spray launchers, tasers, and steel batons. Use my body in collusion with the rumble of SUVs, helicopters, and ATVs, the hum of floodlights and night vision. I never heard rivers say, this land is your land, but not theirs. In fact, I have listened to their currents, offering murmurs of allyship to those who ford across, insisting it is no coincidence that their own watery bodies have been known to follow migratory tendencies all their lives, unless detained behind hulking concrete. Now, rivers mute themselves, fearing mistranslation in arid stretches between where their water trickles into desiccation and where their pulses once reached the ocean to send their currents home. A form of protest, a sort of self-immolation, an assertion of the oath, not over my dead body. I really like projects, and I think maybe I have a problem of liking to start them. And then, or liking the idea of them, but feeling challenged sometimes with the follow through. But I do think of this water project as an ongoing thing that will eventually become a complete collection that I would like to submit for publication to be a book length work. That's still kind of building. But also, I'm really excited about essays, and I'm 43 years old, and I've been hoping to never own a car in my life, and I just got my first car because of just where I live in terms of access to things. And
I used to live in the La Crosse area and have to drive out to Viroqua for hearings sometimes.
Yeah.
And so it is.
Yeah, and if I lived in town, you know, there's a bus that's in town that goes between, now it's like this connector bus that goes between La Crosse and Viroqua. But it's still like, you know, I was getting around by bike 7 miles, super hilly.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, here I am finding myself owning a fucking car. And it's something I'll probably never work out, but I do think that writing an essay about mm-hmm. that might help me figure it out and think about it and mm-hmm. try to put it together in this way that also might be interesting.
Yeah, I do that. I call it writing through something. Like when I'm stuck or churning on something, often I turn to writing as like the way, that's my processing mode.
Yeah.
Is writing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. A few newer ones.
All right.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Okay. So this one also has a migration, immigration theme to it. Not titled yet. We knew there'd be water, but they didn't teach us to swim. We knew there'd be blue, rough, and cold and wild between home and the places that are any place but home, but safe. We knew there'd be boats, and maybe we heard but didn't want to believe that they'd be sad, broken jokes of boats. We got on anyway, compassless, because all that mattered was the bow pointing in the general direction of away. Imagine what might shock someone into leaving home, and multiply that times 10. You already know what drives us to the away places. Don't ask us to show you our scars. All we know is that there is a boat offering passage into possibilities. The human instinct to survive, its own tenacious animal. So here we are, minus a son and half a daughter, meaning there is still something to fight for. And the fight is a shrieking inside our bodies, in the long kilometers on foot, in worn-through shoes. The fight is in the shoulders, tired of carrying so little that strangely weighs so much. The children have it too, the fight raw and red in their throats, because the bruising blisters, because the hunger, because the great grief swelling in such small bodies. What is the word for when the home inside us splits apart, splintering off into slivery bits, the farther we get from the places that raised us? But we step in, looking towards the elsewhere, not because we don't want to look back, but because there's this big cold blue ahead, and we need to know how the packed-in group of us is going to make it from shore of the too broken place to shore of the broken in ways we don't know yet places. Realizing we were never taught to swim, not like this. There is only the motion, the tossing, the gripping, the noise of everyone pressed in, or the quiet of everyone pressed in, or the song that starts in one small mouth, slowly becoming a hymn, an anthem. In the bobbing joke boat boarded bodies, holding on to whatever ropes there are, clinging to these small notes, trilled out to sea, singing, carry us, carry this boat, carry me.
How about one more?
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, this one's in here.
You're going to sound so good, and then you'll get to hear what you sound like. Everyone loves that.
Yeah, does that weird you out hearing your own voice?
Not so much. I was in choir and did a lot of like musical mm-hmm. things in high school,
mm-hmm.
so I got used to it. Yeah. So this one, I think, seems like a really, this almost seems like the essence, like I imagine this being at the beginning or the end of the collection, because it seems like, I don't know, it's something about it just seems like this is what it's about. And it is a spell for healing a favorite body of water. Lie the length of your body along the length of its body, sand grit pressing to forearms and calves, sun-soaked stones melting anything hard in you. Unlace yourself and follow its shifting shore, the skin of your arches telling you about brittle twigs and water-washed feathers. Press your hands to its ferned and mossed banks. Touch the roots that grab hold there. Find a way to talk about it without using the word it. Watch the movement, circles concentricing out along a glassy surface, white water rushing over a tumble of rocks, or the curls of tidal surges as they roll and roll. Sink your fingers into the cool shock or sun-warmed swells. Contemplate your blood, your cells, your marrow. Consider how you and the water are made of each other. Lower your whole self in if possible, air tracing edges of uncovered skin. Offer your heartbeat to the molecules that move wet around you and whisper, may you heal, may you thrive, may you be whole. If you can't reach the water, then lean in close as you can and listen like you would listen to a lover's heart, ears pressed to chest. If you can't get close, then simply turn to face the water's direction and call like a hawk to her young, or sing like mandolin strings, or just hum quietly for all the power water has to clean, to kill, to bring life. Face it and say thank you in whatever way you know how, a gesture, a word, an offering. Promise your beloved water body you will tend to it in whatever ways you are capable. Bring a bag for collecting trash. Practice beholding any water you come across the same way you would behold a rattlesnake poised to strike in your path. It is all holy.
Reminds me that calling everything holy was Allen Ginsberg's solution to the corruption of all life by Moloch, by capitalism.
Yeah.
The solution was to say that, you know, to sort of rebelliously declare that everything is holy.
Oh, thank you. You're the first poet that we've had on the podcast.
I'm so honored.
Yeah.
Really delighted.
Yes. Thank you for joining us in our meeting room and reading us poetry.
Thanks for having me here. It's been delightful.
Now I'm no longer alone, without a dream in my heart, without a love of mine.
Apologize. He's like, I'm not going to apologize. It's true. Oh, my God.
All right. So let's jump right into this. So this is the first of a series of discussions that we're going to have with Gibran about world events from a kind of a larger macro perspective or various perspectives. And we wanted to talk about Venezuela. So starting this month in January, President Nicolas Maduro was declared the winner, had been declared the winner of the May 2018 presidential election. However, the National Assembly of Venezuela stated the results of that election are invalid and declared Juan Guaido as the acting president. I don't know if I'm saying his name the same way that fucking NPR says his name, who, by the way, is so in the tank on Venezuela that it drives me crazy. But it's Juan Guaido, the acting president. And they cited the Venezuelan constitution. And he said, I'm the president, and now the United States, as well as kind of the rest of the allied world of the United States, has recognized that Guaido is the acting president, I guess.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
So one of the things that's worth considering here is that Guaido's party had previously boycotted that election, and there were a bunch of news stories in the U.S. press about how his party and several other opposition parties had been banned from participating in that election. That is not true at all. What happened is that they had been forced to reapply to participate in that election because there's a law in Venezuela where if you don't participate in consecutive elections, you have to reapply as a party to participate. And they had boycotted the previous one. And so they then complained to the Western media, who, you know, were happy to report that they were being banned from these elections, because that is the narrative that has kind of very counterintuitively defined how the U.S. relates to Venezuela in the last like 20 years, which is that the Chavistas are authoritarian dictators, and that because, right, authoritarianism is identical with socialism in that sort of cosmology, and because they're socialists, they have to be authoritarian, despite being particularly Chavez was enormously popular and kept winning elections by like massive margins. And you know, sometimes a massive win in election is something to be skeptical of. But it's also worth considering that around this time, you're also seeing, even in the Western press, a lot of stories. In fact, I found one in Forbes about how Venezuela had, at the time, the most sophisticated election system in the world, or one of the most sophisticated election systems in the world for avoiding fraud. So there's this very weird...
Yeah, I mean, I keep hearing the narrative that the international community, or at least the United Nations, doesn't think that there was election fraud, except... Is there an exception to this particular election, the election of last May?
Yeah. I mean, I this is the first one that seems to even be really in question, to be honest. I mean, Chavez was just staggeringly popular. Maduro is definitely less popular than Chavez, and that's like where we get into some of the kind of like subtleties of this. But I think before we kind of dive into this question of like, well, is Maduro a bad leader, or is Maduro less popular than Chavez? I think we really need to talk about sort of this general, the context of that conversation, right?
Mm-hmm, sure.
And the context is the United States right now is trying to carry out a coup in Venezuela. And there are several reasons for this, one of which is that Venezuela has the largest proven reserve of oil in the world, more than Saudi Arabia. And so they're very strategically important in the same way that like Kuwait and Iraq and Iran and Saudi Arabia all are. All countries which I happen to know a lot more about than Venezuela. But another thing to keep in mind, too, is that the U.S. has a very long history of this, particularly in Latin America. Latin America has always sort of been, since independence, has been a place that the U.S. has regarded as sort of its backyard, its imperial territory, where it will do as it pleases. And so having this, like, you know, socialist regime in this territory of all places is sort of deeply offensive to the U.S. Ruling class, in particular the like foreign policy establishment, for whom, right, socialism is still, you know, this horrible boogeyman, and it will always be a horrible boogeyman in the eyes of the West. Right off the bat, this is a coup. This is a terrible thing. And a very dangerous thing. There's even a possibility, albeit probably pretty slim at this point, of this escalating into like a full-blown war.
And we should remember that Bolsonaro, at least, I can't speak to the Colombian president, but we should remember that the Brazilian president Bolsonaro is as close to a bona fide fascist,
yes,
as exists in Latin America. Today, in my opinion.
He's a bona fide fascist, and not only that, but he stole that election extremely blatantly. And all the narratives of him as like this populist who's like, you know, brought on this radical swell of like Brazilian right-wing fervor is just not true. Guido himself is he's hardly known at all, right? Mm-hmm. He was a pretty marginal figure until very recently. And so, you know, there's not...
So he was created in a corporate boardroom. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
He was not. I don't think that he's a real human being. I think that he is a sort of corporate Frankenstein, and we know whose hands were in that particular cookie jar.
Yeah, absolutely. He was grown in a boardroom. I think one of the other things that's really important to understand about Latin America is that much like the U.S., Latin America has its inequalities arranged in a very racialized manner, even more so than the U.S. in some respects. Like, you have enormously impoverished indigenous populations in most of Latin America still. And in some places, you also have like Afro-American populations too, who are really poor still. And so like one of the things that you'll notice about the opposition is that it is overwhelmingly white. Racial categories are obviously kind of complicated, but they would be considered white in their country, their home country.
When we talk about Venezuelan socialism and Chavez and really the context, the material context in which that movement and that force emerged in Venezuela, we have to talk about it also in terms of both sort of the promise and the curse of nationalizing oil and using oil revenues as a way to meet the needs of the nation. And this is something that, you know, first of all, talking about that, critically assessing it, in no way excuses or vindicates U.S.-led and capitalist world's actions against Venezuela. They're wrong no matter what. Salvador Allende proves that you could be a fucking saint of a Latin American socialist leader. The worst things that people allege about Allende that have even any remote relationship to evidence or truth still put him in a saintly category compared to leaders of all ideological orientations in history. He was one of the better guys. And the point is, you can be that better person as a leader, but if you're a socialist leader, you are still fucked. You are still going to be attacked. You're still going to be maligned, and you're still going to be the victim of coups. Yeah. You could do everything right and still be the victim of coups by the United States. And so it's a red herring in that sense to try to criticize too much. Now, that said, we can, you know, as a movement and as people who are concerned about building a just world, we can say that the dominance of oil as the basis of that economy, and also some of the decisions made by some layers of Venezuelan leadership as to where that economy should go, what type of monetary policy, fiscal policy, and sort of production policies that they had, we can say those might have been less than ideal, and that in a perfect world, we could draw lessons from that while still unconditionally defending Venezuela against U.S. aggression.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would think we both want to get a little bit into some of the discussions of the oil economy. But one thing we should really talk about first is that this is not an isolated incident. We have to understand how the U.S. goes about and does things like this, right? So you all have probably heard about, you know, the sanctions regime against Venezuela. Similar sanctions regimes have been imposed, honestly, almost countless times in U.S. history, but recently against North Korea, against Iran, against Iraq. Before the Second Gulf War, there was like a long period of sanctions against Iraq. And what this sort of regime is intended to do in principle, right, that the foreign policy wonks who like come up with these ideas, they say that, right, we're going to put pressure on these leaders. But really, the point of doing this is to create unrest in a country by decreasing the standard of living there, right? I mean, it's not quite an embargo, but it's almost like a blockade in some respects, right? Like the US blacklists companies that are willing to sell to Venezuela, right? Things like food and medicine, right? You've heard about food and medicine shortages in Venezuela. Well, that's not because the Venezuelan economy is so inherently screwed up. It's because they've been under a massive regime of sanctions, and the state has had a number of assets, billions of dollars in the last like year alone. It's like, what, $6 billion of assets that have been held by Western governments, and the Venezuelan government hasn't been able to use to do things like, you know, buy food or medicine. And so this is done as a sort of, it's done in order to create, you know, internal tension to increase the likelihood of regime change. And it's done in order to create sort of a casus belli, like a reason for war, if it comes down to that. Say, oh, look, they're mistreating their people so much. Well, no, the U.S. is starving people in this country through this sanctions regime and then blaming it on the government there in order to essentially make them look bad, mm-hmm. right? It's sort of waving the bloody shirt. It's creating this humanitarian disaster and then trying to claim credit for fixing it by attempting a coup. But either way, this is essentially, right, like a U.S. coup at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't have tried this without U.S. approval, in part because if he had, and the U.S. had said, well, no, this is illegitimate and bad, don't do this, right, he would have had no chance at all because, right, he would be facing down the Venezuelan government and the U.S. So if this happens, if this is successful, if this is ultimately successful, it will be because of the U.S., and the fact that this is happening at all is fundamentally because of this sanctions regime.
And I love the meme that is the guy shooting all of these different revolutions throughout the ages, you know, shooting the maps of the flags or whatever of those revolutions, and then saying, why does socialism keep doing this?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. While we're on memes, there's this great one of when... Arrested Development, when they're going to buy a house, and they're like, well, it didn't work out for these people. And they're like, well, regime change didn't work out for Iraq. It didn't work out for, like, Honduras. Like, it goes just through this list of, like, 40 places where the U.S. has pulled off regime change. And they're like, but maybe it'll work for Venezuela. And it's like, no, it's not. It's not going to fucking work here.
Zero question also, while we're, you know, talking about U.S. foreign policy, zero question in my mind that this could have happened under a Democratic presidential administration in the United States.
Absolutely.
As well. Zero doubt in my mind that if it were of that same level of opportune moment.
Yes.
In under an Obama administration or under a Clinton administration, that this very easily could have happened. And not to say that administration, you know, might not be more objectively competent to deal with some of those ramifications. But I think when what you're talking about, when the outcome that you're talking about is this imposed regime change on a Latin American country, we really do not have much of a difference in track record between Democratic and Republican administrations.
And this is not contained to Latin America. I mean, to take the Iraq example, right, you had Bush Senior with the first Gulf War, and then through Clinton's reign, through his regime, you had sanctions, you had airstrikes against Iraq in the guise of, like, no-fly zones, and then you had, you know, Bush Jr. actually do the invasion. But, right, that's a through line of consistent foreign policy aimed at regime change. And you see this time and time again, right? One of the few exceptions is when Obama tried to create that, like, bullshit deal with Iran to, like, have them stop their non-existent nuclear weapons program. But that's kind of a different story. But there are occasional exceptions.
And it's like, okay, that is better.
Yeah, that's one of the few good things.
In the sense that we will impose this fantasy on you that will have a slightly better outcome for you than the fantasy that might be imposed and is now being reimposed by Mike Pompeo and company.
Well, and the really important thing about that, right?
And John Bolton, who, by the way, is truly an awful, awful human being on so many levels. But they all are. But
yeah.
But
John Bolton's a real
special,
real
special shout out for old Walrus Man.
I want to point out, though, one of the important things about the Obama era, you know, deal with Iran is that it preserved the basic logic of regime change. It said you are behaving in a way that the U.S. finds unacceptable, which in this case wasn't even true. Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons. And so we're going to shake you down and make you agree to all these conditions that on the basis that you're behaving in a way we don't find acceptable in order to get sanctions lifted. And if you step out of line, we're going to reimpose sanctions, right? Mm-hmm. So despite the fact that Obama did actually behave, you know, more reasonably towards Iran than, like, most recent presidents, he still absolutely preserved the structure and the idea of this sort of regime change campaign, which is something that, again, can last
absolutely
decades.
Two things as we wrap up. Now, first is that Emmanuel Macron has a lower approval rating and more unrest in the streets, or I don't know if more unrest, but a shitload of unrest in the streets in France. And so maybe we should engineer a coup to get rid of Macron. And the second thing that I want to say is that what you just said in terms of what we should push for is a great way to circle back and wrap up this conversation, which is I feel like we have to unconditionally condemn any attempts by the United States and the West to impose regime change covertly, overtly, or otherwise in Venezuela. And we can do that regardless of, you know, how we feel about what the best models are or what the best, you know, types of leadership are. We can say, you know, regardless of that, you know, this is something that needs to be unconditionally condemned across the board.
So I agree with that. And I would actually go a little bit further and say Syria is the perfect example of why even when a leader is really horrible, like Assad is just a total bastard, the act of regime change creates worse externalities.
Sure.
Good side, yeah! In here.
Got it, man. Totally with you in mind.
Thank you so much.